this might be the year that the Bucks have to blow it up. Seriously, we get into that coming up with my guest, Tom Haverstraw. We also talk about Ja Morant's big night, Wemby's 5x5, the Suns, is Ryan Dunn the rookie of the year, Banchero's injury, Anthony Edwards, and a whole lot else coming up next. Starting the season 1-4 isn't the end of the world for the Bucks, but for a team with championship aspirations, that's a pretty uneasy beginning. Giannis Antetokounmpo and Damian Lillard still haven't found their groove together. They've had great individual nights, to be fair, but they don't click in ways that other great duos have around the NBA. Chris Middleton, still sidelined. We don't know when he's going to come back. This core is getting old. It's one of the oldest teams in the entire NBA. Brook Lopez, 36 at this point. How durable is he going to be moving forward when their defense is already weak enough as is? They have a bottom 10 defensive rating. They have the third worst net rating in the entire NBA. The bench is absolute garbage. The prospect pool is non-existent because they've whiffed on so many picks in recent years. They just declined a third-year option for Marjon Beauchamp on Thursday. And to make matters worse, they don't control a single draft pick until 2031. And they're a team over the second apron paying the repeater tax. So even if they did have assets to trade, the second apron rules would limit them in doing that. And oh yeah, Mr. Blown 3-1 lead Doc Rivers is their head coach. So as the title window in Milwaukee quietly creaks shut, I'd bet on yes. And to discuss that, here's my guest Tom Haverstraw coming up after Father John Misty. All right, Tom, is it time to hit the panic button for the Bucks?
Sacramento has light the beam. We need to smash the button. Ooh. Smash the panic button for Milwaukee, and here's why. No championship team in NBA history has ever started 1-4 and won the title, right? So a 1-4 start in general is bad, but also when you consider that every championship team in NBA history has at least started 2-3 or better. Secondly, those four losses have all been by double digits and with Damian Lillard and Giannis Antetokounmpo in the lineup. So right now they have the Eastern Conference's worst point differential, and the schedule isn't even getting hard yet. Four of their next five games are against really good teams, against Cleveland and New York. And so right now, like, I know people are going to say, hey, we just started November and we're already smashing the panic button. It's been that bad.
It has been that bad. And on Thursday night, they lose 122-99 to the Grizzlies. And there's moments in the game where you just, like, you can talk about, you know, their point differential is terrible. You can talk about how their 3-point percentage is bad. Oh, they'll be better shooting. You can talk about how they don't have Chris Middleton right now. They're going to get healthier, all that stuff. But there's just something missing from the fabric of this team from a chemistry standpoint. And there was this play in the third quarter that stuck out to me. They're down like 20 at the time. And, you know, you can say it's over at this point, but it's really not over in the NBA with the way 3-point shooting is now. But there was this moment in the third quarter where Giannis was defending Jaren Jackson Jr. on the opposing wing of a pick and roll. It was a play that was a Ja Morant lob to Zach Edey. And Giannis is defending Jaren Jackson. Taurean Prince is defending Santi Aldama in the opposite corner. And then on the play, as the pick and roll happens, Giannis was shaded towards the nail. And then Prince, as Edey was rolling, offered zero help at the rim. Yep. Edey gets the lob dunk, wide open, it's easy. And then immediately, Prince and Giannis turned to each other and started bickering at each other. It looked like Prince was saying, we were supposed to switch here. You're supposed to take Edey. Prince is probably supposed to cross out and take Jaren Jackson Jr. But then that would have left Aldama wide open for a three. Regardless of what the actual plan was in that moment, I thought it was a good example of many where this is a team that's clearly not on the same page defensively or offensively in any way. And I do think you're right. That is why it's time to hit the panic switch right now with the Bucks, Tom.
Yeah, you wrote a great column ahead of that debacle on Thursday night. And you must have been watching that game being like, this is exactly what I'm talking about, is they just weren't on a string defensively or offensively. And you're right. Chris Middleton could be on the way. And so how can we really say we got to smash this panic button when their third best player, who's a multiple all-star and a key guy on both ends of the floor, is missing? Well, here's why you worry about that. Chris Middleton had surgery on both his ankles this offseason. And when the news report came out by Shams Charania, he said he'd be ready for the season opener. And in the preseason, Doc Rivers said, hey, I hope to see Chris Middleton for a game or two in the preseason. Where is Chris Middleton? So
nowhere
when
to be
you
found.
Hear it,
nowhere.
Yeah. When you hear, Kevin, we're taking a cautious approach, that usually means there's been a setback and they don't want to talk about it, or things have been going much slower than they anticipated and they don't want to talk about it. So Chris Middleton, yes, is very much a missing piece to what they do. But I asked Jeff Stotts of InStreetClothes.com about the precedence for a arthroscopic surgery on both ankles in the same offseason. And the only comp he could come up with in his database was Darren Williams late in his career. Darren Williams, like, not great. He was already kind of on the downside of his career when that happened, but it still goes to show this is very rare and there isn't a lot of success stories after both ankles needed arthroscopic surgery.
And he's 33 years old. And last year, I know, like, Chris Middleton ended the season very well and he performed well in the playoffs. Of all the downsides of Milwaukee's playoff run, again, losing in the first round, Chris Middleton was good individually, but he's 33. Like you said, double ankle surgery. He showed signs of decline last year prior to that. Defensively, he's not the stopper he once was. Even if offensively he's producing, defensively he's not the same guy. And defense is part of the problem for the Bucks here. Yep. Gary Trent, I praised him after their opener. I was like, oh yeah, he did a great job chasing around Tyrese Maxey. He did. And he's had some tough matchups this year. But he got absolutely destroyed by Ja Morant. Destroyed. Basically every single game aside from that Maxey performance this year, and he's their best option.
Yeah. KOC, here's a stat for you. Thursday night's game against Memphis, they gave up 68 points in the paint, to your point. 68 points in the paint. Do you know how many times, with Brooke Lopez and Giannis in the lineup, that Mike Budenholzer's defense allowed 68 points or more with those two guys in the lineup from, all right, here are the seasons. 2019... 2020, 2021, and 2022. In those four seasons, how many times with Giannis and Brooke Lopez in the lineup did they give up 68 points in the paint?
I'm going to say zero.
Zero. You're absolutely right.
Wow. I mean, it was a lot of easy baskets in the paint, too. It was lob after lob, jaw finding cutters. It was easy points in the paint, not like hard-fought stuff either.
Yeah, six alley-oops thrown by Ja in that game. 12 dunks by Memphis.
Crazy.
Okay. That is stuff that the Milwaukee Bucks should be doing, not the Memphis Grizzlies against the Milwaukee Bucks. Like, yes, yeah. Ja Morant has been sensational and like they got bigs that can finish. But when Jake LaRavia, and God bless him, Wake Forest Demon Deacon himself, go Deeks. But when that guy's finishing alley-oop dunks against your defense, there's a problem. And I think, you know, we can blame Doc Rivers or blame the front office. I think it's the whole entire organization. I think changes are coming because you know what happens when you get new ownership. Mark Lazary is not the principal owner there in Milwaukee anymore. It's the Haslam family. And usually when that happens, there is going to be a wholesale change in the near future. Whether it happens this season, after a 1-4 start, a disastrous 1-4 start, where they're having Damian and Giannis on the floor for all five of those games. Their only win is against the 76ers on opening night. I think so there's some wholesale changes coming.
I do too. And I think for the Bucks, like, look, their luxury tax bill is going to be approaching $70 million this year. They're over the second apron. So even if they did have assets, they don't have a first-round pick to trade until 2031. They don't have a second-round pick to trade until 2031. Even if they did have assets in terms of players that had any value around the league, they just declined a third-year option for Marjon Beauchamp on Thursday. Andre Jackson barely plays. Tyler Smith is a raw rookie second rounder. AJ Johnson, talked about him earlier in the week, one of those baffling first-round picks that I can remember in recent history. Ryan Dunn with the Suns, who we'll talk about later. How nice would he look in the Bucks right now? Some of the older guys that you could have drafted that could contribute early. So you take a 160-pound teenager who can't help you. Maybe that's because they're thinking of longer term, to your point about changes coming for the Bucks, because I don't see any reason to draft that guy this year with this team unless you don't believe in this year's team. But even if you did have assets, Tom, there's no trades to make. There's no ways to improve. So what are those wholesale changes that you could actually make? Are we talking already trade Giannis, trade Dame? Is that what you're getting at when you say wholesale changes?
I didn't think that was going to be on the table until the season started, right? But I do think that if this continues and looking at their schedule going forward, there isn't, you know, a lot of easy games coming up. Again, they should be blowing out these teams. They lost to Brooklyn by double digits. They lost to the Chicago Bulls by double digits. Yeah, you lose to Boston. You lose to Memphis with Ja Morant playing out of his mind. Fine, great. But you got to win those games. In the next four games, they've got Cleveland, at Cleveland, Utah, okay? If you're losing to Utah, it's going to be a problem.
They should not lose to Utah. They face Utah next Thursday. If we're talking about a Bucks team, they could very well go into that matchup 1-6, two losses to Cleveland, who's been awesome so far this year. But if they go into our next podcast recording as a 1-7 team after losing to Utah on Thursday night, I cannot imagine what our conversation will be next Friday morning.
Because again, it's weird to have Giannis talking like he has in the preseason about like looking around the staff and saying, are you going to get traded if things go bad? Like, this is a situation that has already got, you know, a flammable quality to it. And then again, Damian Lillard is having a pretty good year at the free throw line. He's getting to the charity stripe all the time. His shot hasn't been falling from downtown, but his true shooting percentage is at career high levels. So Giannis Antetokounmpo is still playing well, maybe not like, you know, MVP caliber, still playing well, but the most important thing is he's playing. Damian Lillard is playing. So the question for me is, do you wait to strike a deal, or at any point Damian Lillard could miss some games or become injured, and then you're going to be dealing with a lot tougher trade equity if you're trying to move Damian Lillard or trying to move off of Giannis Antetokounmpo. You're going to get a ton for Giannis. But yes, when you've got older players like Brook Lopez and Damian Lillard, if you don't trade them now, there's a chance that they become injured, and then it becomes a lot harder to press the reset button.
Absolutely. And I think by the way, I still think no matter how much Heat fans cry about it, this is why the Blazers took that Bucks deal instead of the Heat deal, because they were betting on the Bucks to collapse more so than the Heat. And that's looking like a pretty good bet in this moment right now. As for the Bucks, with their decision, they're not going to get, if they were to decide to pull the plug, they're not going to get as much for Dame as they gave up to get him. So they're in a position now where Dame's value at his age, 34 years old, it probably only declines from here. I still think you can get something very good for Dame, but I don't know if there's a deal out there for the Bucks that allows them to say flip Dame and make it make any sense around Giannis. Like, so many teams have point guards, or they have young point guards that they're invested in. There's a reason why there weren't a lot of teams for Dame the first time around when Portland traded him. There really wasn't too many. So I think for the Bucks, there'd be a limited market for Dame as is, and he's older. For Giannis, there'd be a lot of teams for sure. But ultimately, the reason why the Bucks are in this position is because the supporting cast stinks. They've whiffed on draft picks. They've traded too much away for like the Jay Crowders of the world, 5 second round picks. They are without anything now. And that does really leave them in a position where, look, you're looking at Giannis deals. You're thinking about it. So let's open up the trade machine here and think about some Giannis trades. It's way too early, but that's also not too early at all. Because what if the San Antonio Spurs pick up the phone and they offer the Milwaukee Bucks today, hey, we'll give you Keldon Johnson, Jeremy Sochan, and our best friend Zach Collins, our tank machine Zach Collins. He can help you with 7 future first-round picks, 7 future first-round draft picks. Or what if the Thunder call up and they say, we'll give you Isaiah Hartenstein. This is December 15th. They can't trade him until December 15th. Hartenstein, Aaron Wiggins, Usman Jang with 8 future first-round draft picks. Or what if the Warriors call and they say, we'll trade you Andrew Wiggins, De'Anthony Melton, Jonathan Kuminga, Pods with 2 future first-round picks and a swap? That's probably not enough. Because the Bucks cannot trade swaps in return, so that limits the amount of picks that the Warriors can trade as of now, unless they brought in a third team. 3 deals of those 3. If you're the Bucks, are you thinking about any of them? Do any of them have appeal to you, or are you just trying to make it work around Giannis because he signed for so long term, and you're just trying to move other pieces around?
I think it's Golden State. They have actual real players.
Enough?
I think real players, like real actual players that can contribute right away. When the headliner in the San Antonio deal is Keldon Johnson.
The Thunder could trade, you know, real players instead of Aaron Wiggins. You could say, okay, Lu Dort. You could say Kayson Wallace. If the Thunder could top any trade. The question in my mind from the OKC side of things is Isaiah Hartenstein hasn't played. But the vision for Isaiah Hartenstein is like this elite rebounder, elite screener, all these things. Giannis is not an elite screener. I'm not saying you wouldn't trade for Giannis if you're the Thunder, but there would be some diminishing returns for Giannis in that Thunder ecosystem. There would be.
I'm telling you, man. I'm telling you, Kev. If Milwaukee trades Giannis Antetokounmpo with that, the key piece in the deal is Isaiah Hartenstein, they're going to riot. They're going to riot in Milwaukee. Like,
okay, Jonathan Kuminga is about to get $30 million or whatever he gets paid. Kuminga might make Milwaukee riot too.
Pods, baby. Come on.
I mean, come on. It's like, fire up. The Warriors can offer players, whatever that means. But
yeah.
So could the Thunder. And by the way, Jeremy Sohan is averaging like 20 points, 7 rebounds, 27 and 5 or something like that so far this season. He looks great for the Spurs. He's a player too.
I can talk myself into Kuminga becoming a star, someone at least the fans can get excited about, but not Sohan. We'll talk about him later. Little tease there. Kev, what about Houston?
They could trade the future Suns picks. They have young guys.
They have young guys to put in the trade.
Do you trade Fred VanVleet? That's the salary you probably have to move.
Yeah, and you have Jalen Green, so you have a little bit more depth. We want a free Reed Sheppard, so there either it happens on the Houston side or it happens in the Milwaukee side. But I think Houston's interesting too as a possible trade partner with Milwaukee. But of course, as a second apron team, Milwaukee, you have to incorporate a third team or have some way to make the salary cap work. And again, this is why it's so hard for Milwaukee to go all in on Damian Lillard and the contract, because they don't have any picks left. They traded a bunch of picks to get Drew Holiday. Then they flipped Drew Holiday to get Damian Lillard. And if you look, like you said, they don't control any of their picks basically for the next 6 years. And the reason is because they parlayed everything to get that star point guard. And yes, they got a championship with Drew Holiday. But if things don't go well with Damian Lillard in this era, they have to recoup those assets in a new CBA environment that makes it almost impossible for you to do that.
You know, I think with the Bucks, one of the things that became pretty clear to me in the Boston game on Sunday was, you look at Boston, they have shooters everywhere on the team. The Bucks have a bunch of iffy shooters, non-shooters. Mm-hmm. It's just not the same. Boston had better depth. Peyton Pritchard. By the way, Peyton Pritchard. Domen Rangula had a question for you, Tom. Peyton Pritchard, what's his stat? End quarter heaves.
I got this, man. They don't call me the fighter for nothing. I looked this up at stathead.com. Peyton Pritchard, the last two seasons, has the second most makes at the end of the first, second, and third quarter. So I'm not looking at like game winning. I'm looking at like end of quarter heaves or end of quarter shots. Okay. That's the second most behind De'Aaron Fox, according to stathead.com.
Wow, Fox.
Yeah, there's a reason why he's the clutch player of the year, like every year. Peyton Pritchard is shooting 35% on these shots, which granted, you might be like, that's not that great. It's 10 percentage points higher than the league average in that situation. 25% is the league average. Peyton Pritchard shooting 35%. I'll give you one more. His effective field goal percentage in this situation, end of quarter, I got 1 second or fewer, 1 second or basically buzzer at the end of these quarters. His effective field goal percentage, which is weighted for three-pointers, is 47%, which is 13 percentage points higher than the league average of 34%. His three-point field goal percentage in these situations is 35%, which is just league average in all situations. So Peyton Pritchard, in end-of-quarter heaves on threes, is shooting basically what most players in the NBA would love to shoot. So Peyton Pritchard, end of quarter heaves, end of quarter buzzer beaters. He's elite. If not the best in the game, he is elite in that category.
Well, that answers Dumman's question from Tuesday's podcast that we recorded. Tom, thank you. You're making the point. Peyton Pritchard, GOAT heave shooter, one of the best backup point guards in the NBA. I mentioned in the podcast earlier this week how the Celtics' depth compared to the Bucks' depth was pretty apparent. I felt that way again Thursday night against the Grizzlies, where on the Bucks side of things, it's like, Bucks, please play Andre Jackson. Please play Andre Jackson. Doc Rivers hates to play young players. Whereas on the Grizzlies side of things, they get Jalen Wells starting in place of Desmond Bane, Santi Aldama, Brandon Clark, Jake LaRavia. They sign Scottie Pippen, Jay Huff. The Grizzlies have aced it on the margins, whereas the Bucks have failed. And that's one of the differences I felt in the two teams on Thursday night. The Bucks have just absolutely good. They get an F minus. The Grizzlies get an A plus on those margin moves. And Ja Morant, he was the best he looked all season on Thursday for the Grizzlies. He had 26 points, 14 assists, 10 rebounds. And I was really impressed by those 14 assists. You mentioned the lob stats earlier, Tom. He was manipulating the defense with some little shoulder shimmies, head fakes, ball fakes, some of the lobs to Edie, the cutters that he found, the full court passes. Ja, I thought he was easily the best player on the floor. One of the reasons why I'm a little bit higher on the Grizz than you were in the preseason. Have the Grizzlies changed your opinion at all in the early going this season? I know it's been up and down for them so far.
Yeah, it's been up and down. Ja's been out for a game. Desmond Bane is injured.
Jackson missed some time too.
Exactly. Is that really that variable? The injury variable is why I was down on them. And so far this season, they've gotten a lot of Ja, which is great. I'm just still worried if Desmond Bane is out for an extended period of time, like it looks like, that could spell trouble for them. But they do have a culture. They do have bodies in ways that Milwaukee doesn't. One little note on that Milwaukee thing, just before we move on completely. The AJ Johnson pick. We get mad at the Lakers for selecting Bronny James based on the lack of production at the college level. Where is that same energy for AJ Johnson?
2.9 points per game in Australia. 2.9 points.
We were talking about it at the Yahoo draft show. Lamar Hurd was my guy. He was like talking about this and he's like, keep that same energy for AJ Johnson in the sense that like Bronny James, it was a 55th pick. The Milwaukee Bucks selected a guy with a first round pick that had even worse production or fewer production baseline than Bronny James. So with Milwaukee, it's about culture, right? You have a culture in place. With Memphis, there is a culture in place. Forget grit and grind. You know, with this organization, they've been doing a great job of developing young players and they have consistency in the front office and at the coach. With Milwaukee, they have none of that. No consistency. What does Doc Rivers want? What is the culture around this team? They knew it with Mike Budenholzer. They knew that. But ever since that transaction where they got rid of Mike Budenholzer, there's been no identity with this team. And that's the number one thing in Miami, in San Antonio for so many years, is you have consistency from ownership all the way down. And with Memphis, it's been a consistent line from the top to the bottom. And with Milwaukee, it is nothing like that. So that to me is a reason why Ja Morant can like throw lobs to people that have been playing with the organization for quite a while and they know the system. In Milwaukee, they just don't have that because of so much churn and turnover upstairs.
Yeah, and I think Memphis has done a great job at doing that. I mean, they've not won a title. They've had ups and downs, the Ja suspension, injuries, all that. But they have a lot of good homegrown talent on that Grizzlies team. And Santi Aldama, I mean, Jay Huff, dude. I talked about Jay Huff during the preseason. I sent out a post on X saying, Jay Huff looks like a guy who should be in their rotation. He was on two-way contract at the time, and they've signed him. Look, I did not anticipate Jay Huff would get signed this quick or be in the rotation this quickly for Memphis. But Jay Huff, 7'1", shooting 50% from three on the year, playing 17 minutes a game off the Memphis bench. The Aldama-Huff front court combination is pretty nasty. It's been fun to watch those guys together. And on Thursday, that was one of Jay Huff's worst games of the year, but he's had some bangers. He had 18 points against Orlando last week. I've been really impressed by, I know Memphis is 3-3, but I've been really impressed by some of those depth players. And if they're able to get healthy, I think they have the depth in the supporting cast to have a deep team, a deep roster with a bunch of different lineup combinations that Taylor Jenkins is going to be able to take advantage of at some point in the year, as long as they get healthy. That's the big question with him. As you said, Tom, it's health.
I can hear John Hollinger in my ear already. Just UVA, wahoo, like just he's so excited about all these UVA guys. Like Ty Jerome also.
Yeah.
having a great year. Ryan Dunn also having a great year. UVA is having a breakout season right now. And I will say, a lot of GMs are upset that Tony Bennett is retiring because he has developed some really good NBA players recently. So Malcolm Brogdon, of course, not playing yet with the Washington Wizards. But UVA guys like Jay Huff, they're having a moment.
If you haven't subscribed to the Kevin O'Connor Show already, please do so. We're almost at 200 reviews on Apple as well. Just hit 300 on Spotify. So if you're listening over there, let's get to 200 on Apple. Let's see if we can get to 400 on Spotify as well. It really does help grow the show. Talk to you in a minute. Victor Wembanyama had a 5x5, the second in his career, Tom, on Thursday night. 25 points, 9 rebounds, 7 assists, 5 blocks, 5 steals. Only 3 players in NBA history at this point have had more than one 5x5 game. Hakeem Olajuwon had 6 in 1,238 games. Andre Kirilenko had 3 in 797 games. And Victor Wembanyama has had 2 in 76 games. So Victor has had 1 every 38 games. AK-47 had 1 every 265 games. Hakeem had 1 every 206 games. Over under, Tom, of 49.5 5x5s for Victor Wembanyama in his entire NBA career.
Basically a half season's worth of 5x5s. I'm going over.
Yeah,
I'm going over here, Kev. And
how much over? Give me a number. Let's just say he stays healthy for 12 years or so.
I think he will threaten to average a 5x5 for an entire season. So I would say over 100 in his career. Look, he's 20 years old and he's already got 2, okay? When you look at the 5x5s in NBA history, the average age is 26.8. He is 6 years ahead of what the normal 5x5 is normally seen at. So he's 6 years ahead of schedule, okay? He's 7'5". He hasn't filled out completely. He's fully, skilled. How many guys at 7 feet tall can do the things he was doing on Thursday night? It was the Utah Jazz. And man, Walker Kessler, a poor guy, just trying to defend Wemby. It's been tough. As one of the guys who have a great shot blocking number, but sometimes he just gets destroyed at the rim. The Blazers have had 7 top 10 dunks already last 2 years against Walker Kessler. Feel bad for the dude. But Victor Wembanyama, it's about time. His Chet Holmgren performance was, it was a dud. Got to say it. It was bad. And Kev, I picked Victor Wembanyama to be the MVP this year because I thought we would see this every night. The 5x5 were threatening to do 5x5 every single night. It hadn't happened. He looked overwhelmed by the moment against Chet. Chet completely outplayed him, and OKC will outplay just about anybody in this league. So look, Vic doesn't have the same supporting cast that Chet has, but still, it was great to see this performance, a bounce back performance from Vic. And I got to tell you, I know you said earlier that Sohan has played really well this season and he's got good numbers and maybe that's, a jewel of a trade piece or a trade package. I think they need to move him to the bench because Victor Wembanyama, that is his kryptonite, playing with Sohan. He does not have the spacing. He does not have the same sort of versatility that they can unlock Victor Wembanyama in the half court. In that game, Thursday night, with Victor Wembanyama on the floor with no Sohan, they were 47 points. The Jazz had 23. 47-23 run when Victor was on the floor and no Sohan. That is the trend over the last 2 seasons. When you look at Victor Wembanyama's scoring and his production, forget the plus minus, scoring and production. This season without Sohan on the floor, he's scoring 33 points every 100 possessions. So per 75, it's probably 28 points every 75 possessions. Without Sohan on the floor, he has a 64% true shooting percentage. Compared to when Sohan is on the floor, it falls from 64 to 49. His assist numbers with Sohan on the floor is 3.5 every 100 possessions. With Sohan off the floor, it's 8 assists every 100 possessions. They're like a solid team when they don't play with each other, but when they don't, when they do play together, it just doesn't work out. And I hope Popovich decides, hey, Keldon Johnson, let's promote you into the starting lineup and let's get a little bit more spacing because Sochan isn't it. And he can anchor that second unit and they really need Devin Vassell back.
Look, I'm not against starting somebody else over Sochan. Keldon Johnson, I don't think he's the answer. To me, Keldon Johnson, I'm out. I want to trade Keldon Johnson. You're not the guy that I thought you would be.
For Giannis. Yeah.
For Giannis. Or anybody for that matter. He's just not that guy. He's not improved defensively. He loses weight. He's still no good defensively. Sochan, to me, I blame Pop here. I don't think he calls enough plays for Wemby. I don't think there's enough structure around Victor. There's too many moments where they just throw him the ball at the elbow, gets doubled. It just doesn't have any flow or rhythm, their offense in the half court. They feel like a team that doesn't have the structure that we know from the Spurs teams that were so great for so long. And maybe that's by design for Pop. Maybe Pop, you know, mastermind, one of the greatest coaches ever across sports, wants these young guys to figure it out on their own as part of a learning process. But it sure would be nice to see a bit more structure and a bit more creativity in the half court when you have Sochan, who, yes, he has these flaws, but he's 6'8". He can play make a little bit. He can screen. He can play in the short role. I just don't see a lot of creativity with a piece like him with Victor Wembanyama. So, yes, I agree that Victor performs better operating in more space. But I also think Popovich can do a little bit more creatively to get it to work with the pieces that he has. More than anything else, though, they do need Devin Vassell. They need Vassell in that starting lineup. He unlocks so much for that team, and Vassell is so underrated. He's a great shooter. He's a great pull-up shooter. He can run pick and roll. He's a smart cutter off the ball. He just adds a completely different ingredient that nobody else on that Spurs team has. Now, with that said, though, I think the other thing they have to do, you think they needed to, you know, move Sochan to the bench, have him operate on bench units. I think that's okay. With the bench unit, they got to get rid of Zach Collins. Unless they intentionally are trying to just absolutely hemorrhage points to help their tanking odds and lose more games, which I would not blame them with this draft class up top. I would not blame that at all. They need to have Mamu come off the bench over Zach Collins. Mamu's better. Yeah. He looked great on Thursday. He's looked great every time they've given the team chances. Zach Collins is a negative. He is a zero. He is a complete detriment to this team's chances of being competitive. Not that Mamu's changing everything. Maybe moving Sochan to the bench helps the bench. Having Mamu play over Zach Collins also helps the bench. And they need Devin Vassell back. I think the Spurs have a chance to get back in the play-in. I do. Yep. I do. They're just going to make some tweaks.
I do too. I think if they make the playoffs or are in the running for the play-in and you know get the 8th seed in the West, I think there is going to be Wemby MVP chatter. I do. Because of the stats he's going to put up, but the offense has to be better. You're absolutely right. With Wemby on the floor, their offensive rating is 101. 101 in today's NBA. Can you imagine all the other 29 head coaches in the NBA looking at that figure? Like what I would do if I had Victor Wembanyama in my offense, who's a constant lob threat, who has skills off the bounce. He has passing skills. He was doing behind the back passes, no look passes on Thursday night. The things that he can do offensively, I know defensive player of the year candidate every year for till the rest of his days, right? But offensively, if you have Chris Paul, Harrison Barnes, and Victor Wembanyama on the floor, you have to imagine that you can do better than 101 offensive rating. Greg Popovich absolutely deserves it. He's the GOAT, right? He's the GOAT. But we can also say that this team should be way better than what they're showing.
They got to be. It's on Pop. Pop's got to get more creative. I want to see some more wrinkles to that offense develop over the course of the season. You have Chris Paul as your point guard. You're going to have Devin Vassell back soon. You have Victor Wembanyama. Can we see some creativity? I'd love to see it. Some bad news that came out on Thursday. Magic forward Paolo Banchero is going to be sidelined indefinitely. He was diagnosed with a torn right oblique. This sucks, Tom. A lot of injuries piling up around the NBA, it seems, already this season.
Yeah, he will be the sixth all-star from last year who's missing games this year. So
how many was that?
Paolo Banchero.
Six, seven? Six of them. Wow.
six players that were All-Stars last year that are haven't missed at least one game. So it's Banchero, Scottie Barnes, Joel Embiid has not played, Steph, Paul George, and Kawhi Leonard. Six players, and three of those have not played a single game. If you want to expand that list, here's a list of star caliber players or notable players that have missed games or missed the season so far. Chris Middleton, we talked about. Kristaps Porzingis has not played. Brandon Miller, missing game. Zion Williamson, Andrew Wiggins, Miles Turner, Ja Morant, Jaren Jackson Jr., DeJounte Murray, another one, and Bradley Beal all have missed at least one game this season. So that's what, like 15, 20 names that right off the bat in the first five games of the season have missed all or some of the games for their teams. So this is why I call the league, the NBA, on paper league, is because on paper, we only can talk about these teams on paper. On paper, the Milwaukee Bucks should be a title contender. On paper, the Phoenix Suns should be one of the best teams in the Western Conference. But that injury variable is so just, it looms large for every team in the NBA. And I know people say that this is the league of parity. Like, now we are seeing new champions every year. I don't think we talk enough about how injuries are as much of a factor as that parity of teams winning and going deep in the postseason. We never used to have this issue in the NBA where star players continually missing playoff games, where star players missing tons of regular season games. But that's what this era is. It's the era of guys not playing 82 games, but 62 games. And you're seeing it now with Paolo Banchero, a really difficult injury for the Orlando Magic, but just another name on a long line of injuries to star players.
I mean, sometimes it is the most durable teams. And I know, like, the conversation around Boston and their postseason run last year was, oh yeah, they're getting through the Heat without Butler and the Cavs without their guys. And oh, no Halliburton with the Pacers. That was all true. But there is also something to the fact that Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are two of the most durable stars in the NBA. And that is something that works in favor of Boston compared to these other teams where guys are just missing games all the time. And it's, as you said, perfectly said, really, on paper with this team, that team, this team, that team. With Boston, you pretty much know you're going to have Tatum and Brown out there. And now with Orlando, a team that people said, oh yeah, maybe they can make some noise and maybe make a little bit of a run. Well, you better hope Paolo Banchero gets back healthy. You better hope that he's able to stay healthy this season, because a right oblique injury is scary.
With a bull like that, you know, yeah. Like a guy who is just so strong and fearless with the ball. I mean, I don't know how many players of that size come back from that type of injury and what that looks like. But for me, the play that he got hurt on was exactly the play I'm worried about with him and that injury going forward, is he's just bulldozing his way to the rim and collides with Vooch and just falls to the ground and is grabbing at his oblique. That's a painful injury. And for someone like that, it's going to be in the back of his head. Like, it's a mental thing too. It's not just a physical thing, but just, am I going to feel that bite back if I go against three guys defending at the rim? It's something you think about. You know, ankle injuries, the same thing. Like, Chris Middleton hurt both of his ankles landing on someone else's foot. When he comes back from his double ankle surgery, is he going to be the same type of player, or is that going to be in the back of his head? And that's unfortunately a very real and a real part of the game that we do have to talk about, is not just when these guys get back, but what kind of shape are they going to be mentally and physically?
Tom, you wrote an article on Yahoo Sports earlier this week titled, "The NBA Rookie Class is Off to the Worst Start in League History." That was Wednesday you wrote that. As of Wednesday morning, no rookie had 15 points or played over 30 minutes per game, which is amazing. But since then, Dalton Connect has had 18 points. Risa Shays had 17. Bub Carrington, Jalen Wells, and Ryan Dunn all had 16 points. Did the rookies ruin your week?
You know what, rookies? You're welcome.
Yeah.
You're welcome. I was the reason why all those guys, you know, got a good night's sleep, you know, after reading that article, had a good nap in the afternoon.
F this guy. Screw him.
They decided not to eat as much fried food or candy on game day. They just decided, you know, I'm going to prove Tom Haberstroh wrong, this idiot over there at Yahoo. Look,
dressing like Pitbull for Halloween. F this guy. He stinks.
They're saying Dale after their performances. Look, man, even with that, Kev, even with those, we're still at historic lows for that type of production. Even with, you know, Bub, Risa Shea, Ryan Dunn, if you look at through the first five games, and not every team has played five games, with that caveat, it is the second fewest in the team's first five games in NBA history in terms of 15 or more points. So even with Bub and Zachary Sashay and Kinect.
And this is also factoring in, like, the scoring is up now. Like, there's more players scoring 15 points.
Exactly. And at the top, you mentioned the 30 minutes per game. I'm saying more than 30 minutes at any game. At any game, they hadn't played in the season up to that point, up until Wednesday. No rookie had played more than 30 minutes in any game. And that is a regularity. Every year we have number one through lottery picks routinely playing 30 minutes in the game schedule. So a couple more numbers on this. First five games, 15 or more scoring by rookies. Right now we have four. There's five if you count Wells, but he was in the sixth game. So just apples to apples, first five games, there have been four players who had at least 15. The previous seven seasons, Kevin, the average total after the game of the season's first five games is 18. We've had four. So that's 4.5 times fewer than we normally see in today's era. And when it comes to more than 30 minutes on any game from a rookie player, we have had three so far this season in the team's first five games. And usually we see 14 at this point. So yes, they did show out on the night of that article dropping, but even still, they are way lower than they have been historically. And I posit to you, I'm sure you read that and you were like, you had a bunch of thoughts, but do you think this is a sign of, I guess, macro teams are less trusting of young players? Do you think it's a product of they're super young? This was, I think, either the youngest draft class or right up there with the youngest draft class. Do you think this is just a product of they're not that good?
I don't think it's that they're not that good. I think it's right now in the early going this season, mostly everybody's trying to make the playoffs. Most of these teams are trying to get in, get a top six seed, or at least compete for the play-in, and that they're just investing in some of their best guys. Like, even for the Wizards, yes, you have Alex Saar. Yes, you have Carrington. Carrington gets 15-plus points, but you also have Jordan Poole, a guy who's getting a lot of touches. Bilal Coulibaly in his second year, who continues ascending, and had a monster game the other night, by the way, for the Wizards with 27 points. He also had 23 points against the Cavs last week. He looked tremendous so far this season. So you have a lot of guys, even on the Wizards, you're like, we got to be competitive. Sar's going to get his chances over the course of the season. And Sar's more of a defensive player anyway at this point. So I think even for a team that's crappy, like the Wizards, You're investing in some of your other guys in the early going this season. I think that investment will come later in the year for a lot of these teams, but I don't necessarily, maybe I was wrong to say a guy like Zach Edey will win rookie of the year because Memphis has so many other guys.
Well, he has a pretty strong case now. You know who doesn't have a strong case?
Reed
Sheppard. You said it.
He's not even playing.
He had
barely
5 minutes.
Yeah.
What do we got to do? Kev, what do we got to do to get Reed Sheppard some playing time?
He had Seriously. 3 minutes earlier in the week too. It's consecutive games. 6 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes.
We got to free Reed Sheppard. We got to. The dude is too good to be basically glued to the bench in the doghouse of Ime Udoka. He's too skilled. I know that they've got Jalen Green going off. Fred VanVleet's up and down. But we got to see more minutes from Reed Sheppard. How do we make this happen, Kev?
It's going to be tough, man. Because they have a lot of guys. It's a product the team's trying to win. It's a product of how deep the league is nowadays. There's just a lot of good talent. But you need to find a way to get Reed Sheppard minutes. You have to. You can't be playing him under 5 minutes routinely. You have to find minutes for a guy like that. But for Houston, I think the counter argument is, like, if you're Ime Udoka, you're like, okay, so I have Fred VanVleet. What am I supposed to do? play it, not play him over 30 minutes a game? Am I not supposed to play Amen Thompson, another young guy? Am I not supposed to play Cam Whitmore? Am I not supposed to play Tari Eason? Like, where am I taking these minutes from? I'm sure Ime Udoka will say. Reed Shepard's a rookie. He can go play in the G League. That's probably what Udoka's thinking. No. Why do I have to give this kid minutes?
Don't do it.
Right now.
Don't do it.
Go play,
we
go
can't
play with
free
the G
Reed
League.
Shepard to the G League. Come on, man. It's going backwards. We need more Reed Shepard in the NBA.
I'm with
you. You know what?
I'm just playing the role of Ime Udoka here. What do you suggest, Tom? Who am I not playing as much?
I don't know. Maybe Milwaukee would play him.
Oh, maybe. But you know what, really, what I think the answer is? You got Fred VanVleet playing 37.4 minutes per game. Play him 30. Yeah. Give Reed those extra 7 minutes. Simple as that. And if he really stinks, then start playing VanVleet a little bit more. But you got to get Reed out there for at least 15 minutes a night.
I think so, or else why did you draft him third overall? You know, he earned it last year. He earned it this summer league. In preseason, he was sharp. And so I just feel like we need to see more Reed Shepard. But you know what? We got more stuff to talk about, I'm sure. Man. But I'm going to start the free Reed campaign.
Yeah, I'm with you, Tom. We both also had him number one on our boards. So we have an investment here in Reed Shepard. But I'd say the one rookie that has stood out the most to me this season and preseason is Ryan Dunn from the Phoenix Suns. On Thursday, he had a monster game as a rookie. He had 16 points on 4 of 9 from 3, harassed James Harden all night long. So far this season, the guys he's defended most often have been James Harden, Luka Doncic, and LeBron James. Ryan Dunn shooting 71% from 2, 44% from 3, averaging only 7.8 points per game, but shooting the hell out of it. Rookie of the Year, Tom, is usually an offensive award. This might be the year we see a defensive player win Rookie of the Year. Would it be wrong to have Ryan Dunn first in extremely early Rookie of the Year rankings? What do you think?
I think Bob Carrington and the Wizards fans would have something to say about that, but I would go with Ryan Dunn at this point, especially because this guy is doing it on both ends of the floor for a team that's trying to win right now, right? You can say Alex Saar, Bob Carrington, Kaishan George have nice stories over there in D.C., but Phoenix is trying to win right away. He's getting a lot of trust from Kevin Durant and Devin Booker and Mike Budenholzer. Okay. Like that says enough right there that he's getting big time minutes as a rookie with those guys. And secondly, you know what kind of achievement that is for the front office? That last year they played zero rookies, 0 minutes. They didn't play a rookie the entire year. And this is a front office. I think the story was with Kevin Arnovitz at ESPN. A couple years ago, they had basically said, we don't care about the draft. We're punting on the draft. We don't think that they're going to be able to contribute to a winning championship team right away. And here you have, out of nowhere, this like little puddle in the desert of rookiedom in Phoenix coming in right away. And yes, he's a little older than a typical rookie at what he's like 22 years old at this point. But still, this is a great success story for a team that had abandoned the rookie class altogether last year, the only NBA team to do so. And now they could have a guy who's going to win Rookie of the Year. It's remarkable, really.
I do think he should be number one in Rookie of the Year rankings so far. It's early. I'm sure somebody else will surpass him that gets more touches, more offensive opportunity at some point during the season, if that even happens, to your point with your article earlier this week, Tom. But so far, Ryan Dunn would be number one, in part because of his individual elite defense, but also his team defense as well. He's an elite off-ball defender, shot blocker, help defender, picking off passes as a help guy, causing deflections. Ryan Dunn's been awesome. And I think he's a good symbol of this overall completely reshaped Suns supporting cast. Royce O'Neal, they get him last year. Looks like an awesome 3-and-D guy for them so far this year. You bring in Tyus Jones. You finally have a point guard. You got Grayson Allen coming off the bench for this team. Ryan Dunn. Nurkic, he's okay. Plumlee, he's okay. Iguodaro, we'll see if he can pan out as a rookie as well. The center spot is really the only weakness for the Suns right now, but I think overall, you get the Suns. They've beaten the Clippers twice. They beat the Mavs. They beat the Lakers, and then they had lost a competitive game to the Lakers as well. Booker has 40. One night it's him. One night it's KD. Earlier this week, I noticed with your title tiers on the Finder with Tom Havisher, you can subscribe on Substack. You moved them from 2 stars to 3 stars as title contenders. What have been the factors that have made you move them up a tier as a title contender so far? I'd imagine it has something to do with how that depth has supported those stars.
100%. And I should have seen, you know, when you got a supporting cast of Tyus Jones and a full season of Royce O'Neal, things will look different. And Mason Plumlee too. But I can't foresee Ryan Dunn being this guy right away. I'm sorry. Who could have predicted that he'd have more three-pointers already through 5 games of the season than he did the entire year at college last year for UVA? He had 7 three-pointers the entire year for UVA, and he's already surpassed that total in the first 2 weeks of the season. So Ryan Dunn showing up and becoming that 3-and-D piece right away, knockdown shooter from the corners, is one of the reasons. Nuts. And then also, so
Tom,
just
Ryan Dunn, sometimes you hear things pre-draft that's just complete BS. With Ryan Dunn, I heard from a couple of executives and scouts and a couple people in the agent world who are like, yeah, Ryan, like, you ask around, who are the guys standing out in workouts? And a number of people said to me, Ryan Dunn is shooting the hell out of the ball. And I'm like, really? Ryan Dunn shooting the hell out of the ball after he was a negative from beyond the arc at Virginia. He was a detriment beyond the arc. He was a great interior finisher, a great screener, a great connective piece, but not a shooter. It's like, okay, this is just one of those fake things you hear. But I heard from enough people, I'm like, okay, I'll bump Dunn up my board. It feels like this intel is strong. It's from a lot of trusted people. I moved him from like in the 30s to in the teens. Something, I forget the exact number. But it is one of the most amazing developmental stories if this sustains for Ryan Dunn. This turnaround is unlike anything because he's not shooting 44% from three on an attempt per game. He's shooting this percentage on 4 attempts per game. High volume with some tough contested shots as well. It's unbelievable that this is actually happening.
I'm no Chip England, but that stroke looks great. He's got a great 3-point shot. So it's confident. Mechanically, it looks sound. That looks like a guy who shot threes 6-7 times a game in college. And it looks that confident and that mechanically sound already. You know what I'm saying, Kev? Like, you watch it. That looks like a dude who's been shooting threes all his life. And it just started happening a couple months ago.
You never would have anticipated it. And one of the other things with him, he did shoot more threes in high school, but even then it was still a smaller sample. This is a different level than anything else. So you think it's the depth. The depth is what makes you feel more confident in them.
Yeah. And Budenholzer recalibrating the shot profile of this team. They're 9th in 3-point rate. Their offense hasn't even gotten into that high gear, but I do like that prospect for them is that they're just getting healthier shots. And I think that Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, and Bradley Beal should all be shooting way more threes than they were given the percentages. And so that's why primarily I've bumped them up, but also some other teams like Philly, other teams that have Milwaukee, for example, that I've had to downgrade. And for every East great that has to move down, that just means that there's another opportunity for other teams to get into the title picture. And Phoenix right now is giving me every reason to believe that they're a legit title contender. I just still get a little nervous about how old they are and how offensively minded they are. They're a top 10 defense right now, and hopefully that sustains itself for the rest of the year.
For next Tuesday's episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show with the Mailbag, I want to hear from you guys about the players and the teams that have been underwhelming to you or that have exceeded your expectations. So let me know at kocshow@yahoosports.com. Tom, earlier this week on Yahoo Sports, I wrote an article with the headline, Anthony Edwards is shooting it from deep like never before. Is the three ball evolution good or bad? It was kind of about Anthony Edwards as an intro into the league-wide discussion that a lot of people have been having about three-point rate now cracked over 40% for the first time, Boston even further increasing their three-point rate this year, and how other teams are having to do it. And Minnesota has been one of the teams to increase their three-point rate the most. And that's largely in part driven by Anthony Edwards himself. He's taken 90 shots this season. 53 of them have been three-pointers. I brought on Dane Moore, a great Timberwolves podcaster, earlier this week to talk about Ant's evolution. I'm curious about your thoughts, though. They're facing off against Denver on Friday night. First time those teams have been able to face each other again this season. I want to know your thoughts on Anthony Edwards. Is this a good thing for Anthony doing this? Do you want to see more from Anthony Edwards of getting to the basket, drawing fouls? Or is this just something that he has to do in order to beat the Bostons of the world?
So I think if he was taking these threes at the expense of low efficiency mid-range jumpers, I would say absolutely he should be taking these threes. Because the fact of the matter is, if you're shooting 36% on long twos or 36% on threes, guess what? You should be taking more threes. I mean, my 7-year-old daughter can point out the math that you shouldn't be doing a lot of these mid-range jumpers that you can't get, you almost never get fouled on. You're never going to the free throw line for. And with 3-point shots, you get the added bonus of the point, obviously, but you do have a higher foul rate on 3-pointers than you do on mid-range jumpers. So if you're shooting 36% on threes, you have to shoot 54% on twos to make up for it. Right? The math at 36% is a 54-55% two. You're not going to do that on long range twos. You're not going to. Unless you're Kevin Durant, unless you're Kawhi Leonard, you're not going to really shoot that efficiently on long twos. So if it's really a product of him moving a step behind the line and shooting that many threes, I'm all for it. However, Kevin, when you look at the numbers, Anthony Edwards has had one dunk this season. One. And it came in a fast break circumstance. So that means that Anthony Edwards, who last season had some of the best half-court dunks in NBA history, I guess in his entire career, Anthony Edwards going to the rack has produced all-time great highlights. He's had one dunk so far in the half-court, I mean, in the entire season, and it didn't come in the half-court setting. So last year, he had over 60 dunks in the regular season. His dunk rate is 1/5 of what it was last year. So Anthony Edwards, it's not just that he's taking more three-pointers, and he's shooting really well at them. So I don't have a problem with the actual volume of three-point shooting. It's if he's not attacking the rim and he is not going at the rim normally, that what we normally see with Anthony Edwards. So that's what I have a problem with. It's that he's settling for threes at the expense of attacking the rim. And that might be just, dude, I just played in the Western Conference Finals. I just played in Paris. And I'm not going to compromise my body for these amazing rim attacks at my age when I'm trying to win a championship. So I guess my answer to that is I like seeing the three-point volume from Anthony Edwards, but not at the expense of the high-flying acrobatics that we love to see from him.
Only 9% of his shot attempts have come within 3 feet of the rim. He was at 23% last year. And as a rookie, he was at 31%, just to give some perspective on the subtle decline each year with him. 9% for Anthony Edwards is just, it's not enough. Unless, like you said, he's just saving his body. He brings it back in the playoffs and he starts going to the rim all the time. Maybe that's what it is. But I'm not totally convinced of that. He did get hurt in the West Finals and he wasn't getting to the rim as effectively during those West Finals either. I think there's some concern there as well in my side of things. Maybe that he's still feeling that. I don't know. I have not heard anything about that when I've kind of poked around about that, but it's just very interesting to see this dramatic rise from 3-point range and then this just dramatic decline at the rim, whereas the mid-range stuff is fairly similar to what it was in terms of his trends in recent years as well. So it would be one thing if he were removing the mid-range diet in favor of threes, as you said, but he's not. He's removed the at-rim stuff, yeah. And the dunks are just not there for him. And so I think with Anthony Edwards, I want to see him find a better balance over the course of the season. I think it's important for him. I want to see that to have any faith in the Wolves as, you know, a finals contender.
As a larger conversation, though, Kev, I thought it was important to hit the Anthony Edwards as the face of this thing. It's just like, here's this Michael, people thinking he's the next Michael Jordan, and look at all the similarities with Michael Jordan, and yet he's, you know, turning himself more like Damian Lillard. And I think from a product standpoint,
It's not good for
you
the
don't
league,
want that.
For your potential face, no.
You don't want that, you know, like Damian Lillard's awesome. Steph Curry's awesome. He's not those guys, but he's trying to be with this kind of volume. And I do think elite three-point shooters don't take enough three-pointers because the math says so. Like, I think the math shows that elite three-point shooters should be taking 10, 12, 15 three-pointers a game. And Anthony Edwards at this rate, like, yeah, if he's 41% from downtown or whatever it is, he is going to want to take that many. The math says so, but not at the expense of rim attack. So there's that. But I do think that all of the teams who were thinking maybe we should take more threes this year just watched the Boston Celtics win a championship at that kind of volume in ways that wasn't just about Steph Curry and the Warriors. Like Steph Curry and the Warriors, people would look at their teams and be like, we don't have a Steph. We're not going to take that many threes. But when the Boston Celtics are doing it with their entire roster launching threes, you're going to get teams like the Orlando Magic right now are shooting 50% of their shots from downtown. Orlando was at like 36% of their shots coming from beyond the arc last year, and now they're taking more than half. Now, I want to see how that kind of balances out with Paolo Banchero out. Maybe they take more to compensate for the loss of their star player, but I think Orlando's such a good example of a team that just watched Boston go nuts against the rest of the league and then go, yeah, we got to shoot as many as those guys do.
You have to shoot that many to keep up with Boston. You have to. You're going to lose the math battle. It's a necessity to keep up with Boston. Dallas found that out in the finals last year, but they're one of the teams that they haven't really acted on it. They're not shooting more threes this season, and they're not shooting threes well this season either. They are 14th in the NBA in three-point percentage so far this season. Dallas also is only 12th in three-point attempts on the season. But for the most part, most teams are jacking them up more often this year. They're following that Boston trend. Three-point rate is up over 40% on the year. And you got guys like Anthony Edwards. I think your point is spot on, Tom. This isn't just about the Wolves. It's not just about NBA. Should they move the three-point line? We'll have much more time to talk about stuff like that. But it is about the face aspect where he was ascending. Will this be something fans latch on to? I'm not totally sure. People want to see dunks. And I know there's theories floating around out there about how, yes, more threes leads to more dunks. More threes leads to more driving lanes, more attacking lanes. And yeah, that makes sense in theory. But I got some help from Synergy Sports with looking at some of the trend data with three-point shot attempts and the effect it has on dunks, percentage of shots at the rim. Synergy sent me over some stuff about that. And obviously everybody knows the way the percentage of three-point shots have just skyrocketed over the last 20 years. Up over 40% this season. It was nowhere close in the 2000s. Nowhere close even pre-Warriors, pre-Rockets. Dunks per 100 field goal attempts back in the 06 season. There are 3.7 attempted dunks per 100 possessions. This season, 5.7. So you're getting two more dunk attempts per 100 possessions. You're getting many, countless more three-pointers per 100 possessions than you were back then. I don't think the effect of three-pointers is overly dramatic on the amount of dunks that we're seeing. You're getting a couple more attempts per game. You're getting a few more, but many of those are going to be fast break opportunities, not in the half court. I don't think the effect there is as much as some of the defenders of the increase in threes say it is from a highlight standpoint. I think the anecdotal examples of fans saying, no, it's getting to be too much, is something that the league needs to at least be listening to and thinking about when it comes to using the G League to just try some things out. Just try some things out and see how it affects the game. You get this minor league that you've used for a bunch of potential rule changes over the years. I think this year, it's too late probably, but next year, it's time to experiment with a different three-point line or multiple different three-point lines in the G League starting next year.
I love it. Let's use that as an incubator. There's a lot of kind of rule changes that are being implemented right now in G League. I'll save it. I'll save it for a column or maybe a KOC episode next week. I got some ideas about how we can kind of balance this out. And it does make me think more. Like, I would give it to you now, but it's not fully baked. So I want to make sure that my research and my idea, because I don't do things kind of like, you know, like I got to get all my muscle behind me before I come out with a strong take like this. When we're talking about changing the game, I will say, your data on the from Synergy. So it's basically 3-point rate more than doubled and dunks basically doubled. But what we're saying in the aggregate, like we see one more dunk every game, yes, but we see 12 more threes every game. So we're not really noticing the eye test. You would never really pick that up that, man, I'm seeing twice as many dunks in NBA games. And you're not picking that up, right? Even though it's double the amount. So I get what you're saying.
And it did flatline. It flatlined as well. 5.7 this year, but in 2014, it was 5.5.
Right.
So, like, and three pointers are the biggest increase happened. Yeah. Exactly. Yes.
I think also with injuries going up, you might have players like Anthony Edwards thinking twice about going hard at the rim in the regular season to preserve their bodies and do the whole load management thing and playing style. I think we don't talk about that enough, is that like there's load management in missing games, but I think there's also load management when it comes to playing style. And it's simply easier on the body to shoot a three-pointer than it is to go up against 3 7-footers in the lane at full speed. So that's part of this too, is there's more space and there's more skill to get around guys and get up and dunk. But I think a lot of it is, hey, I want to be ready come June rather than January.
So Tom, you dressed as Pitbull for Halloween, I saw on your podcast, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. Honestly, not awesome. A lot of work.
You look just like Pitbull.
I know. I was thinking to myself, I was like, yeah, really, I pulled it off. But like, what does that say about the way I look that I was able to pull it off so easily, Kev?
I mean, the suit looked great.
Did
what do you mean? What is it that says good things? Look great, Tom.
I guess we all should want to look like Pitbull is what you're saying. You're right. Yeah. You know, like the thing that scared me the most was the NBA playoffs promo was 10 years ago with Pitbull. It's been 10 years since the Kesha playoffs Timber video. And that's crazy.
We're getting old.
When you think about it.
Mm-hmm. You have a good Halloween?
I had a great Halloween. It was a little too hot for me to bust out the full suit, the full Pitbull suit. It was like Miami weather outside Thursday night, I should say. But I do think that Wemby has that on lock, not just the 5x5, but Wemby, his Halloween costumes, he's batting 1,000.
I mean, 2 for 2. He was Slender Man last year. And then this year from the movie Spirited Away, he was the No Face character from Spirited Away. And it looked just spot on like No Face. I haven't seen the movie Spirited Away in many, many years now, but it makes me want to rewatch it.
Well, and, you know, LeBron is like a huge I've been to Halloween parties where LeBron, you know, he's been when I was covering the team in Miami, where LeBron is like all out on Halloween night. It's good to see that the torch has been passed to a 7'5" guy who is absolutely embracing how freakish size he has for Halloween. Did he have like a fan inside his costume or something like to create that flutter?
And Victor's?
Yeah,
like it was like kind of like a second person in the costume.
No, no, not a not a human being.
I misheard. A fan. Like a blowing wind.
Like a blowing wind. Yes. Yes. I was wondering if he had like a handheld blower inside. You know what? We should just stop this conversation at this point where we're talking about handheld blowers and fans and all this stuff. Listen, man. It was an awesome costume, and I'm now very excited for every Halloween as long as Victor Wembanyama's around.
I had my best Halloween. Went to a concert, saw David Gilmour, the guitarist from Pink Floyd, at the Hollywood Bowl. Sensational show. I did not get dressed. I wore a black shirt. You could say maybe I got dressed as David Kilmore. He wears black on black. That's how I got dressed. Black on black last night. Also, I had to wear a hoodie, though, because it was cold in L.A., but hell of a show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was very cold. A lot of wind. I don't know if you've ever been to the Hollywood Bowl, but it gets windy in there. So wind was howling through, and it was cold. They were definitely cold on stage as well, but it was a pretty incredible performance. David Gilmore, 78 years old. 78 years old. Legend from Pink Floyd. Been touring with him since the late 1960s when he replaced Syd Barrett. And still feels like he's in his prime playing guitar. Unbelievable.
You know what? I saw on Saturday night here in Charlotte, James Taylor. Also a legend, playing for the Hurricane Helene relief show here at the Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte. And James Taylor still got it.
Wow. Still got his voice. Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Still got it. And his acoustic guitar, just classic signature riffs that he does. He wasn't asking a backup guitarist to do it. He was bringing it. So James Taylor, Carolina in my mind for the audience. It was really special to see. I didn't expect that to get David Gilmour, James Taylor, and LeBron James all still bringing it at this stage of their careers.
James Taylor from Boston, Massachusetts, by the way. Tom,
that's right.
Thanks for joining me on this Friday, man.
Hey, anytime, KOC. Pumped and jacked as always.
Thank you to John for producing today's episode. Thank you to you for giving it a listen. Please give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening to it. It does really help us out. Hope you enjoy your weekend.